Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Just a few days remain before the midterm elections, and candidates for major races make their case before voters at debates this week. Granite Staters react to the shooting at a Pennsylvania synagogue that left 11 people dead, and a Bitcoin embassy opens in Keene. What exactly is that? These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're going to talk about them this hour, and this discussion would be incomplete without you. Call us. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to encouraging civic engagement by providing objective information. Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and reporter Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter. Good
morning. Hey, Peter.
Also, listeners, we are broadcasting a live video of this radio show, so you can watch at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And again, the number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. So let's start with last night's debate between the two major party candidates for governor, incumbent Chris Sununu, Republican, and Democrat Molly Kelly. It was the last chance these two will debate before the midterm elections. And let's start with you, Dean, and start with the tone of the debate. Well, how would you describe it?
Well, it had the feel of two candidates essentially making their final arguments. They covered a lot of familiar ground. It largely was a debate about the good economy in New Hampshire, in a sense. You know, Governor Sununu has run on the argument that the good economic times are here, low taxes, more money for infrastructure, also a focus on the opioid crisis, and has tried to paint Molly Kelly as an old school Democratic tax and spender. And so Kelly has been in the position of arguing that, well, yes, the economy is doing very well in New Hampshire. We have under 3% unemployment, but it's not benefiting as many people across the state as it should. So it was really an argument about the nature of the economy. It's obviously good, but is it benefiting everyone to the extent it should? And this sort of underlying debate over taxing and spending. But I thought they both did a good job. I don't know that it's going to move the needle one way or the other. The race has tightened a bit in recent weeks. Kelly still seems to be down somewhere in the 6 to 8 point range, but a lot of it's going to come down to turnout next week.
Anna Brown, what do you think?
Well, what I thought was interesting about the debate last night was you saw Molly Kelly really pivot towards education. The family and medical leave issue has been the cornerstone of her campaign for months. But last night she was talking more about school vouchers. She was talking about funding for the university system. And she invoked Betsy DeVos. She tried to tie Sununu to that. So that was what was interesting to me, was sort of trying to reframe the campaign a little bit, maybe at the end here, kind of add that second issue in. The other thing that I thought was interesting is they touched on the Northern Pass and the biomass bill and Sununu accepting so many donations from Eversource. And they are both kind of, I would say, maybe not what you would expect falling on the environmental spectrum. So Sununu, even though he's a Republican, he said, I absolutely believe that humans contribute to climate change. And then on Northern Pass, he was saying, I think we should do this because, you know, I think that it's renewable energy coming down. And that's one of the reasons why he supported it. Whereas on the biomass bill, Kelly, which was going to give subsidies to the North Country for biomass power plants, Kelly said she supports it, even though, of course, it has been criticized for some, you know, biomass is perhaps more polluting. So that was another thing that I thought was interesting, is sort of this sort of tricky navigation of the environmental issues in New Hampshire's electricity bills, since they are very high, but we are also as a state trying to transition to more renewable energy.
And Kevin, what did you think about the debate?
I thought that Molly Kelly
pointing out a lot of the differences she has with Chris Sununu. I think that's really important in this race. You're not trying to do the unthinkable, but you're trying to scale a high mountain. I mean, there's only been one governor in the last 90 years who wanted a second term and didn't get one. That was Craig Benson back in 2004, a Republican who was defeated by John Lynch. So we're one of only two states with a two-year term. But voters here are very accommodating to governors who want a second term. It's very hard to fire a governor after 2 years. And Kelly was trying repeatedly, whether it was the as Anna was saying, whether it's the environment, energy, guns, legalizing marijuana, education, on all these issues, trying to say, you've got an alternative. I've got a different view. I'll bring a different voice to this race. Sununu, I thought, acted very confident and optimistic about his chances of winning on Tuesday, but certainly wasn't dismissive of his opponent. He did at one point say she failed to offer any details, nothing concrete. That was another one of his mantras, that she's very critical of him, but she doesn't have specific solutions of her own. That's what he constantly kept coming back
and,
to.
You know, as Kevin mentioned, by all the traditional metrics that we would look at to decide whether or not a governor here is going to get a second term, you can pretty much check those boxes for Chris Sununu. So the question is, what kind of help is Molly Kelly going to get from a broader blue wave or a backlash against the Trump administration? I thought it was interesting last night in the debate. I don't think there was any real direct focus on President Trump or DeVos was really the only mention, which I think in a way shows that Sununu has been successful in kind of charting his own path, because the Kelly campaign has tried in the past to kind of paint him with a Trump paintbrush. And in that debate, there was really no mention at all of Trump. And so that's a success for him if his goal is to kind of chart his own path.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the debate, because one of the things you mentioned, Kevin, was that they did touch on marijuana policy. Asked about a report released this week by a commission that's been studying the question of legalizing recreational marijuana in the state, Governor Sununu did speak a little bit about it. He defended his record on marijuana, citing decriminalization and also expansion of medical marijuana. But he did draw the line at legalizing recreational marijuana.
And the idea that we want to legalize something just so we can tax it, I think that's the absolute wrong direction, right? We have surplus funds right now. So before we take that step, and it is a big leap, look at the states around us. Massachusetts, Maine, Vermont, they don't even know how to implement it. They're struggling to figure out the implementation of it. So the fact that the Democrat Party as a whole has embraced the full-blown legalization of marijuana, I think that's a very dangerous place to be, given the severity of our health crisis. We're making investments in the opioid crisis, in addiction, and we have to have those results before we move forward.
And Molly Kelly was asked whether cities and towns should have the right to ban sales of recreational marijuana if it does become legal in New Hampshire. She didn't directly answer that question, but she did reinforce her position on legalization.
You are correct that I do support legalizing marijuana and highly, highly regulating marijuana and taxing it as well. So I think it's a state's responsibility. We put it through state legislation. I would support it. And through the process that we go through in the House, the Senate, and legislation, we will bring forward a bill to legalize marijuana that works for New Hampshire, and I think we should do it on a state level. I do not believe that it is a pathway to any other drugs. In fact, I think just the opposite. It keeps these drugs out of the hands of drug dealers and people away from drug dealers, and we need to address the opiate epidemic, as I had said earlier.
Listeners, we're going to address that report later in the program. If you've read it or seen a summary of the report and you have an opinion on it, send us an email now. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. But Anna, I want to turn to you first on this. How much do you think voters care about this issue? Is this a huge motivating factor?
Well, that's interesting because so at Citizens Count, we regularly ask about issues on Facebook, in our email newsletter, on our website. And let me tell you, marijuana legalization is quite possibly consistently the highest response rate in terms of people wanting to chime in. They're really passionate about it. And also, you'll see that at public hearings at the State House. I've gone to a couple marijuana legalization hearings, and they've had to move them to reps halls because there are hundreds of people who want to testify. So I think that this is perhaps sort of a sleeper issue that people don't realize. It'll be a question, though, is it enough to get someone off the couch into the polls?
Yes, good question indeed. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there is a group of voters in the state for whom this is a very important issue. They're almost like old school single issue voters, who this is a thing that really drives them to the polls. The political climate around marijuana and social acceptability has just changed so much. I'm thinking in my own lifetime, and there was a time where you were essentially disqualified from being nominated for a federal judgeship if you had smoked marijuana at some point. I mean, it's just remarkable the extent to which it's become accepted. It's been legalized all around us in the other states. It's legal in Canada. People see this as a big source of revenue. The one underlying issue, and you heard Governor Sununu address this, is the issue of the debate over whether or not it's a gateway drug to other types of substance misuse. And that's the big debate. It's been going on for a long time. I don't think it's been resolved. But people who support marijuana legalization say that, you know, either way, whether it is not, whether you consider it not a gateway drug or you consider it a gateway drug, having it kind of out in the open and legalized and regulated would be a good thing. And certainly public opinion shows general support for it. But it's going to, you know, we're seeing the issues that other states are having in terms of implementing legalization. And, you know, we probably have some of those here, too. You remember medical marijuana took like 2 years to get up and running.
Okay. Well, we're going to talk next about the debates between the congressional candidates. And we want you to weigh in if you have thoughts. Did you watch? Do you have a candidate you support? Do you have an issue that's important to you in the congressional races in CD1 or CD2? We're going to talk about both in just a moment. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Okay, CD1, I feel so sad. This is like the last time we're going to talk about this before the election, but we should talk about it. All right, so Democrat Chris Pappas and Republican Eddie Edwards, they met once more on a debate. They touched on a few issues, and notably one of them was civility. What points, Kevin, do you think were the candidates trying to make on the issue of civility?
Yeah, I think they basically were trying to say that, especially this was in the wake of the shooting at the synagogue, the massive murder at the synagogue, that that it's important to have civility and that we're losing civility, certainly. And as Eddie Edwards said, the first thing we need to do is stop demonizing one another. When someone disagrees with you, I don't think it's time to call them names. It's okay to disagree with a black person and not be called a racist, to disagree with a gay person and not
be called homophobic,
to disagree with a woman and not be called sexist. That's what Edwards said. Of course, Edwards would become the first black member of Congress from the state of New Hampshire, and Chris Pappas, the Democrat, would become the first openly gay member of Congress from New Hampshire if he was elected. And Chris Pappas as well called for a more civil tone and blamed the president for being too divisive and sometimes too willing to fan the flames of fear and racism.
Mm-hmm. Anna, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting how they both are arguing for more civility. You know, both of them would characterize this as we need more civility, but they're kind of focusing on different sides. And of course, Edwards has been trying to frame Pappas's campaign as he just wants to resist Trump. Of course, the famous, he was wearing the resist t-shirt at the Portsmouth Pride Parade, and that caused a lot of debate. So the other thing that I think is interesting, though, is they want to overcome divisiveness. They both argue that it's too divisive, but they ask the question, when have you personally faced discrimination in New Hampshire? And they did both kind of dodge that question, which I can understand, you know, as a politician, that could be a pretty heated question. But they both basically said, no, I've never faced any discrimination in New Hampshire. That's not something I've seen. So I thought that was interesting.
Dean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it seems like it's a pretty close race. Some polling has it very close, anywhere from a dead heat to Pappas leading by 6 to 8 points. There are really significant ideological differences between the two candidates, and I think you saw that reflected in the larger discourse in the debate. You know, Edwards is trying to paint Pappas as, in addition to the issues about resisting Trump, paint him as kind of a big government liberal who's going to take away your liberty and who is going to basically support big federal government programs that interfere with the free market. If you listen to Edwards, he talks a lot about free markets and letting the free market chart its own course, and that in a way government is just kind of interfering. He has in the past referred to taxes as a form of punishment, essentially. So there are sort of real clear differences there. And Pappas is trying to make the case that, you know, government can actually do good if programs are properly designed and regulations are not overly burdensome. And he kind of points to Edwards talking about weaning people off of Social Security. That's been a nice talking point for him. about the role of government. So it's a very classic ideological debate about the role of the federal government and what that role should be and how it relates to free markets. And I think it's been a good discussion, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so, Dean, and anybody else can weigh on this as well. Did we learn anything new about these candidates? We've heard so much about them in the past few months, but did this week's debate reveal anything new about them?
It's a function really of how much you've paid attention. I mean, I've been watching this stuff. Yeah. I've seen every debate. I've listened to them many times. So for me, it was just kind of, it was sort of a reasonable way to wrap up. But I don't think there was any major news made in any of these debates. Somebody who's really kind of tuning in the week before the election, you got a good feel, I think, for who they are, what their temperaments are. They've all kind of worked out some of the kinks in their repertoires from having done multiple debates. I didn't see any major news come out of these. I don't think it's going to fundamentally change the race, but I could see where it would be useful for somebody who's maybe not watching every single debate or following them very closely.
Anna?
I would kind of say, just thinking of those voters who maybe this is the one debate they watch. So unlike us, sure, they haven't been following it all along. Right. The one thing that I didn't notice come up that voters might be interested in is more about healthcare issues, because I think that Chris Pappas has really made that the cornerstone of his campaign. And so that came up a little bit. Pappas used the question about opioid addiction treatment funding to tie back into his support for Medicaid expansion and what he did that on the executive council. But we didn't really get into, what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act. Where does Edwards stand on that? So I think that maybe that's what voters who watched would have missed.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the back and forth between Chris Pappas and Eddie Edwards in the debate this week. Here's what they had to say with respect to the opioid crisis.
And the best tool we have to fight the opioid crisis is Medicaid expansion. I was proud to provide the pivotal support to implement that program, which now covers 53,000 individuals in our state. Unfortunately, my opponent would have voted against it back in 2014 when Republicans and Democrats came together to craft that solution. So that's just one thing that is working for the people of New Hampshire. We need to continue to insist on more resources to invest in strategies that hold the promise of allowing us to turn the corner on this.
Mr. Edwards, you've been invoked. You can respond.
Sure. I think it's pretty clear that the taxpayers can't catch a break with Chris. They can't. That entire rant description did not talk about the irresponsibility of the pharmaceutical companies that created this problem and holding them accountable. Then he turns to more government, where he wants a socialized medicine program, a Medicare for all program, that's going to cost this country trillions of dollars, going to bankrupt this country, and he won't be honest about this. And we won't tell you how he's going to pay for it. He just wants more government. He can't imagine a system where the free market is involved and we actually hold people accountable.
So folding essentially three issues there together, at least the opioid crisis, healthcare, and taxes, feelings about government in general. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think this is why this is a marquee race. I mean, there isn't every 6 years we have an election like this in which there isn't a U.S. Senate race. So we look for the race that's going to attract the most attention, going to be the most competitive, going to be most compelling, and it's by far this race. It's not the race for governor.
And that clip actually nicely encapsulated my earlier comment. You heard free markets, you heard governmental spending, you heard the expansion of Medicaid, which is a federal program administered in the states, and so that really is, in a nutshell, sort of their two competing positions.
Ask the leaders of both political parties, who are the rising stars in your party? And the Democrats will say Chris Pappas, and the Republicans will say Eddie Edwards.
We've got a comment from someone harkening back to the conversation we were having about the gubernatorial debate. Jordan didn't watch, but asks, did the topic of commuter rail, arguably an economic, transit, and environmental issue all in one, come up at all between Kelly and Sununu? And Jordan says, for the record, I am a huge supporter of commuter rail to Boston, and it in fact may determine if I choose to remain living in New Hampshire. So commuter rail, did it come up?
Yes.
Yeah, it did.
Okay. Yes, and Molly Kelly said in particular that she supports commuter rail, and she criticized Chris Sununu, saying, see, he supports it, he doesn't support it, he flip-flopped. And so Chris Sununu's argument, of course, is basically, is this going to benefit the taxpayers of New Hampshire? Is it going to be another subsidy?
And she posited it as a way to attract younger residents to stay here.
I believe that's where it came up, was in a question
about
attracting younger residents.
Yeah, exactly. And so, she did criticize him because he had that moment with was it Amazon headquarters
where
he threw in commuter rail as an enticement and then backed away from it.
All right, listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We're speaking with our guest today about the week's news. Coming up after the break, we're going to talk about the last debate for the race for Congress in New Hampshire's 2nd congressional district between Democrat incumbent Annie Custer and Republican Steve Negron. Did you watch? What do you think? If so, who's your candidate? What issues matter to you? Now's your chance to call 1-800-892-6477, or you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page where we are broadcasting a live video of this radio program. This is The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Amanda from Barrington turned her Mini Cooper into Morning Edition.
I'm Rick Ganley with David Green and Steve Inske.
Vicky from Hudson turned her Audi into the news from Audi.
Published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And Greg from Dover turned his Porsche into laughs with Peter.
You actually found something more evil to do. I think that's great.
Before you trade in your vehicle, consider the value it'll bring to supporting your favorite programs on NHPR. Learn more at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to encouraging civic engagement by providing objective information. Kevin Landrigan of the Union Leader and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email if you have a question or a comment. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And of course, we're on Facebook. You can watch a video of this radio broadcast. Just type in NHPR Exchange, all one word, in your search, and you'll find us there on Facebook. So let's start this part of the discussion, rounding up the debate between incumbent Democrat Annie Custer and Republican Steve Negron. Custer is seeking a fourth term, but she's got to beat Negron to get there. And I want to ask you about your thoughts on this debate. How did Annie Custer do, in your view?
I think she did well. The thing that's when you've been in office for 6 years, you have a big record to run on. And so she was able to say, you know, talk about her bipartisan opioid commission, work she's done with veterans in the North Country. And, of course, Negron tried to use that to criticize her. You know, he said, all right, you said you've been working on the infrastructure on the North Country. We've spent all this, you know, millions of dollars on studying a 911 system. Where is it? You know, but so I think that, you know, Custer did well. I think also that Negron really did a good job of showing how passionate he is. I think that's one thing I noticed is he was very animated on the podium and on some issues. He refused to, you know, back down, such as abortion issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's hear about those things, because we have some tape from an exchange there. Social issues have been prominent in the CD2 race. Here are Congresswoman Annie Custer and Representative Steve Negron responding to the possibility that the Trump administration may change the definition of gender, tying it directly to someone's sex at birth.
It's surprising for me that a Republican administration that ostensibly cares about the individual would be making these assertions. I think, again, this is a very private, very personal decision. I can't imagine a more private decision. My opponent voted on the transgender bill that the government should make this decision. I disagree wholeheartedly, and I disagree with the president's decision.
I think the people on the other side of the aisle want to just, you know, blob onto science when it comes to global warming, but they ignore science that really there's only two sets of chromosomes, right? But they think that they can change that. I don't believe you can. And on the transgender bill in the House, I absolutely did vote against it because it took the right of a parent away from us about seeking treatment for my child. And that's not the role of government to tell me as a parent what I need to do for my son and daughter. And for those reasons, I voted against it.
So there they are spelling out their positions on that. Dean, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I've said before that of the major political races this midterm election, this has been the least visible, which is usually a good sign for the incumbent. It's just not getting a lot of attention. You know, Annie Custer has had a big advantage in money, in visibility. She's been up on TV for a long time. I'm just starting to see some Negron ads on TV now. And so that gives her some built-in advantages. You know, we've talked before about how the second CD has become increasingly leaning Democratic, and Negron is a very conservative candidate, particularly on social issues and on climate change. And I think Custer has done a good job of exploiting that. And the other side is Negron has argued that he's made the argument that, you know, after three terms, she's kind of an absentee congresswoman. She's been captured by Washington, and she always votes with Democratic leadership. And, you know, the reality is most House members vote with their leadership. That's just the nature of the chamber. But nonetheless, he's tried to paint her as someone who's had an opportunity to do something and has kind of been AWOL, and she's had to push back against that. So I think it's been an interesting race, but she's got some real advantages here, and I think it's going to be a challenge for him to take that seat.
I want to ask you one question about Annie Custer, because, yeah, I mean, it seems like she has voted with Democrats more than 90% of the time. However, from some of the campaign messaging, you might guess that she's running a little more towards the center than you might imagine.
Right, and that's a reasonable strategy for the second CD. It's for many years it was represented by Charlie Bass, a pretty moderate Republican, who became increasingly moderate over the years in office, with the exception of 2010, when he kind of pivoted and painted himself as a Tea Partier for 2 years. So I think that's a reasonable strategy for her. You know, it's a pretty centrist district, but I think it's just slightly left of center now. And she's in a position where she can do that, and she can kind of pick and choose from her record to fit that particular storyline.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you if you have thoughts on the week's news. The number is 1-800-892-6477. If you'd rather not talk, then you can send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's talk to Cameron in Manchester. Cameron, thanks very much for giving us a call. What's your question or comment?
Yes, good morning. Thank you for listening. I'd like to know, with regard to the remark that Chris Pappas would like to expand state Medicaid to help with the opioid crisis. I'd like to know specifically, however, with regard to Medicare, how he's going to also expand coverage in that regard, because I personally am in recovery, and I'm finding it really difficult since the Trump administration's changed the guidelines for my Medicare to get coverage. So I end up paying out of pocket for stuff like substance use and mental health care.
So Medicare for you, Cameron, has changed in some fundamental way under the Trump administration, is what you're saying. And you're asking about whether Chris Pappas has a plan to address that?
Correct.
Okay. Well, let's put that to the panel. Anybody have thoughts on that? Clarity on Chris Pappas's position about Medicare?
Yeah. Chris Pappas has talked during a campaign about allowing Americans to have the option to opt into Medicare if they wish to. It wouldn't be a requirement that everybody who doesn't have health care coverage has to get it through Medicare, but it would be an attempt for folks like Cameron who might have difficulty with not being on Medicare or not getting enough benefits on Medicare to purchase health insurance through a Medicare for All program and then tailor that coverage to their needs. So if there's you get a substance abuse rider if you have a history of addiction. If you don't, you wouldn't purchase that part of the coverage. That's the design as it looks. As the debate unfolded, Edwards has criticized Pappas for not saying how he'd pay for that or what would really be the cost of that, and he has referred to it as socialized medicine.
Cameron, thanks very much for the call. Really appreciate it. Listeners, if you have questions about the week's news, whatever it may be, we'd love to hear your question or your comment, 1-800-892-6477. Now, Friday after the roundup last week, the Supreme Court of New Hampshire made a move on SB3 because there was a lot of twists and turns regarding this controversial voting law. Essentially, Anna, the Supreme Court said SB3 just has to stay in place through the election, that the changes that were suggested by a judge would be too confusing, according to the Supreme Court.
Yes. It was certainly a dramatic week for voting laws in the Supreme Court. And we've talked to some town clerks and moderators as part of updating our app and website. And they've just been, what are we doing? What's happening? There's a whole lot of confusion. So basically now SB3 is going to be in place through the day of the election. So that means if you are registering on the day of election or registered in the last 30 days, you're going to have to provide additional proof that you intend to stay in New Hampshire permanently. You don't have to provide that at the polls. You'll have a certain time limit after the election to mail or show up at your town clerk's office with that additional proof, but that's going to be in place. The one thing that does remain is, so when this law passed that said, all right, you have to show that you're going to stay in New Hampshire, there were also fines attached to it.
Right.
And those are still off the table. There was an earlier injunction that took those out. So no one is going to face any monetary penalties for anything like this.
Okay. And the Supreme Court justices also didn't really weigh in on the merits for or against SB3, correct?
Correct. Basically, they both made an argument that the law would be confusing if we changed it anytime. If we changed it, you know, 2 weeks before the election, one way or the other way, it's just going to create confusion. And unfortunately, I think they did create confusion.
Yeah, the intent was to clarify, but it didn't quite work out that way. So what happens after the election now? Is there going to be further movement on this?
Well, the court case is still in play. So right now, what the Supreme Court said is that injunction on the entire law goes into place on the 7th, right after the day after the election. The interesting thing is, so there's that period where it's 10 to 30 days where someone has to return with proof of residency if they didn't have it. I've called the Attorney General's office and the Secretary of State, and I know they're very busy with calls. I haven't heard back yet what's going to happen with enforcement of that. Because if the entire law, there's an injunction on the entire law starting the 7th, does that include people coming back to provide proof of residency? So that's that. I think that part is still a little ambiguous. But after the election, in theory, the whole law is off the table.
Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think, well, in answer to Anna's question, I've talked with state prosecutors about this. And essentially, we're talking about an act that has been stayed through the election. So if you don't have your identification on that election day, then they can follow up with enforcement of that. But back to Anna's point as well, they can't penalize you for it. So those penalties don't go into effect. This was really a threading the needle decision by this court, and it cited some other states in which changes have been made in the middle of election cycles. The Supreme Court in particular, I mean, I've talked with justices even on background about this. They view elections as sacred ground, and they're really reluctant to make changes in the middle of an election cycle. And it's not that they disagreed with Judge Brown's case, as you pointed out. It's just they were really uncomfortable about setting up a different system right before an election than had been existing with the law we had until the injunction.
Worth mentioning, too, and Anna, correct me if I'm wrong, citizenscount.org has information about voting and voting procedures, what your rights are. Yes?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Go to our website, citizenscount.org. We also, the New Hampshire Voter Guide app, which is available in iTunes and the Google Play Store, has a voter FAQ.
Okay. And we've also got some voter information at nhpr.org. Helpful links on where you can vote in your area. Citizenscount.org, too, has a great breakdown. You've asked candidates questions about their positions, the state races that may not have gotten a lot of attention in the media. But if you really want to know what your state representative or senator feels about a particular issue, check out citizenscount.org. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the week's news, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. We'll turn now to the news that's been dominating national headlines for a moment and hone in on sort of the local reaction, and that's the killing of 11 people at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania on Saturday. It prompted sadness, fear, anger, a full range of emotions. And there was a response here in New Hampshire. Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about that response here?
Yeah, there was quite a lot of faith services that occurred out in Portsmouth for this. Interfaith organization, a number of religious leaders came together to have readings and folks speaking with their own condolences about what had happened. And Portsmouth police and local and state officials said they stand with the New Hampshire's Jewish community and that they'd work to keep them safe. There was a real outpouring, I think, particularly on the seacoast, but even in other parts of the state with just a horrible tragedy that occurred, and to try and make it clear that this hate and violent act can't stand without people protesting it and in a respectful way.
Yeah, and I think you'll see that again this weekend, today and tomorrow.
Yes.
There's been kind of a call nationally for people of all faiths to go to synagogues around the country and join in remembering the victims and essentially continuing the vigil.
Mm-hmm. Anna?
Yeah, well, the other thing that's interesting is this did come up in the debates. So I think that gun laws was brought up in the gubernatorial debate, in the congressional District 1 debate, and the District 2 debate. And generally, it is an argument the Democrats favor a red flag law or something like that. And a lot of the Republicans are concerned that there would be privacy issues with that, issues with someone being able to be removed from the list. So there are immediate policy implications, not just, sort of you know, you're voting on this on Tuesday. It's it's not just that there's another vigil. It's another horrible thing. This is immediate consequences.
And President Trump made the comment about that things might have been different if there had been armed guards in the synagogue in Pittsburgh.
Right, yes. Should people be able to carry
And that brought us back to Parkland and the whole argument about armed guards in schools. And so it kind of reignited that whole debate about whether you, you know, do you, is the issue here better regulation of guns, or is the issue just changing the way in which people protect themselves in public places?
And on the exchange earlier this week, Elizabeth Leahy, director of the state's civil rights unit at the New Hampshire Department of Justice, was asked whether the Pittsburgh shooting can be called domestic terrorism.
I think you certainly can, and there's overlap certainly with the statutes that deal with bias or hate crimes and also terrorism. It's an act of violence coupled with, you know, a mental state. And so whether it's motivated by race or a political ideology in sort of how we define terrorism, there is overlap. And I don't think we should be reluctant to call these types of acts terrorism, because I think that's what they are.
And as of yet, as of Friday morning, there is, as far as I know, no domestic terrorism, no legal charge there. So these cases often result in hate crimes charges or other charges. And there is debate in the legal community as to whether we should have a domestic terrorism law.
Sure. So right now, at neither the state or federal level, there is not a criminal penalty for being a domestic terrorist. And the idea is, a domestic terrorism law, you could potentially punish people also for supporting an organization that was labeled as a domestic terrorism organization financially or through some other means. And the argument against it, and also it would be make it easier to track those events. The argument against it would be, all right, if we're labeling certain organizations as terrorist, how could this impact free speech? I do think it's interesting to note this morning, I did look to see where New Hampshire in particular stands on this issue. So we do have hate crime legislation, which basically means if a crime is substantially motivated by a person's race, sexual orientation, religion, et cetera, that you can have enhanced penalties. We do not have any specific terrorism statutes. In 2016, there was a bill that would have extended the death penalty to, quote unquote, acts of terrorism and civil rights offenses. So, for example, if it was perpetrated against someone voting or going to church, and that bill was killed because it was once again thought that it was too broad.
Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Linda in Durham. Linda, thanks very much for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling to correct something that was said earlier when you were talking about SB 3.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I misheard, but I believe that Anna said that what you had to show up at the polls with is to prove that you plan to stay in New Hampshire indefinitely, and that's actually not right. What you have to show up with is proof of your domicile. The 1264, HB 1264, which will take effect next year, is requiring you that once you prove your domicile, you have to switch, you have to become a New Hampshire resident and get a New Hampshire driver's license and register your car. But that's not in effect right now. So all you have to do when you show up is to bring paperwork that proves your domicile. You do not have to bring any sort of proof that says you plan to stay here indefinitely.
Okay. Clarify, Anna?
Sure. Yeah. And thanks for the call. I probably did say the word residency, which this goes back to this whole debate. I was definitely using it more just in the sense that New Hampshire is your home, because you're absolutely correct. As of now, New Hampshire still has different legal definitions for domicile and residency. And SB 3 does not have to do with the legal definition of residency. It just has to say, is New Hampshire really where you're intending to stay in for an extended period of time, however long that might be? So, for example, proof would be car registration, but it's not required. It could also just be enrolling your student in school, a letter signed from your landlord, that sort of thing.
Okay. One more story that we should talk about before the break, and that is the story of a Rochester man who killed his parents as a teenager more than 2 decades ago. He'll remain behind bars for at least another 17 years. Kevin, you were covering this case in 1996 when it first happened. So can you remind us of the details here?
Yeah, this is like New Hampshire's miniseries, you know, incredible story about Robert Dingman, who's now 40 years old. He was a junior at Spalding High School when he and his 14-year-old brother, Jeffrey, shot their parents, Vance and Eve Dingman, in their home in February of 96. Now, they were tried, and Robert, the older one, he was 17 at the time, his younger brother 14, but Robert was convicted of 2 counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without parole. But the U.S. Supreme Court made a ruling actually some years ago, found that life sentences without parole is a constitutional violation if the defendant was a minor at the time of the crime. Even if the defendant, who was a minor, was tried as an adult, it doesn't matter. So this had to go through a resentencing hearing process. And both sides have been preparing for this for more than a year. The Robert Dingman's prosecutor had pushed for relief since he's been in prison for 25 years. The homicide head prosecutor, Jeffrey Strelzin, asked for two 25-year sentences. So that would require him to serve an additional 25 years. Judge Tina Nato essentially handed down two 20-year sentences, which means he'll have to be in prison for another 17 years.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We've been speaking with our guests today about the week's news. We've got a lot more to talk about this morning, including that report we mentioned earlier on marijuana policy in the state. Lots of details in that. We can talk about a few of them. Also, a man claiming to be the business partner of Republican State Representative Frank Saporetto is suing him for assault. The suit claims that the business here was the production of a pornographic film. We'll talk about some of the details on that. Listeners, if you have questions or comments, please give us a call now. We'd like to bring you into the conversation when it starts. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or watch a video of this radio broadcast at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Granite Staters head to the polls on Tuesday, capping off a tumultuous midterm election season. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me for live coverage of the races at the top of the ticket in New Hampshire and around the country. We'll also keep an eye on down-ticket results that could affect the balance of power in our state house. Our complete election night coverage begins at 7 Tuesday evening on NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, reporter Kevin Landrigan from the Union Leader, and Anna Brown, Director of Research and Analysis at Citizens Count, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization committed to encouraging civic engagement by providing objective information. I'm spelling all that out, Anna, multiple times because you're new to the Roundup, at least for when I've been hosting it.
Yes,
so we're super happy that you're here. Yeah, really, really happy. And because SB3 is such a thorny story, lots of angles to it, you wanted to clarify one thing about
SB3. I did. And that is, if you live in New Hampshire, if you call New Hampshire your home, you can show up to the polls no matter what and vote, even if you don't have an ID with you, if you don't have any other a car registration or anything. You don't have to show up with any of that paperwork, and you can sign affidavits. You can follow up later. Please do not be intimidated from going to the polls just because you're unsure. What paperwork do I need? What am I going to be asked? You can vote.
Okay, good to know. Thank you very much, Anna. And again, resources for voter information at citizenscount.org and at nhpr.org. We're going to put links up to both of those specific websites at the show page for this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup broadcast. In fact, it's already up, says producer extraordinaire Ellen Grimm. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Ellen. So let's talk about a few more stories here. One of them has to do with the marijuana policy report that we've been talking about a little bit. The new report aims to present the pros and cons of marijuana legalization for state lawmakers as they consider any future bills. Dean, what are some of those pros and cons?
Yeah, this is something we've all been waiting to see. We talked earlier about how there's an increasing push among some residents of New Hampshire for legalization. The one thing we were all interested in hearing is what they would target potential revenue at. They're saying, I think, $57 million in potential revenue. Enforcement costs would be at least $13 million, so you kind of have to balance that out. And, some of the issues about how old is, some places it's 21. Would it be 18 or 21? Should you have public consumption? Who should be able to consume in public? I think the study said is not in favor of public consumption. Have four licenses, I think, to cultivate around the state. And to have set up a cannabis commission to kind of oversee all of this, getting back to our earlier discussion of the debates, and I think Molly Kelly mentioned having it, you know, having this done at the state level. So, you know, we'll see whether this moves the issue forward. They were pretty clear that they just kind of wanted to provide the pros and cons and not so much push one particular position.
And Representative Patrick Abrami, Republican from Stratham, he's the chairman of the Marijuana Legalization Study Commission. What has he said about this report, Dean?
I don't have a specific quote on
Kevin or Anna.
No, sure, I'd be happy to.
Yep.
He talked about the need to basically have this disclaimer that there are members of this commission,
for example,
that represent New Futures and law enforcement that oppose recreational pot legalization. So he wanted the consensus to be here are the pros and cons. There isn't consensus among this commission about whether pot should be legalized, and they did come to some agreement about some restrictions if recreational pot is legalized. For example, this commission opposed allowing marijuana smoking or consumptions in hotels, lounges, or social clubs. But it also basically said that if it is legal, you should allow for a limited home cultivation of recreational pot. And the chairman basically said so much of the focus of this commission really was about taxes and revenues. How much would the tax be? And at that rate, how much would the revenue generate? And they had a lot of support from the Department of Revenue Administration that looked at other states and had some models for how much it would bring in. And that's why we ended up with the high end of $57 million.
Other stories we're following this week. The owner of a failed water park in Candia is being ordered to pay more than $1.3 million in restitution to his investors. The New Hampshire Bureau of Securities Regulation is ordering Kevin Dumont to pay back 22 investors for failing to disclose key information about the Liquid Planet Water Park. Dumont is also facing $125,000 in fines for selling securities to the public without proper registration. Dumont has 30 days to appeal the decision. Dumont gained national attention in 2015 when he chained himself to the top of a water slide over concerns of an impending foreclosure. So if that name is familiar to you, perhaps that's why. Also this week, worth mentioning that the Executive Council on Wednesday greenlighted contracts for new addiction treatment hubs across the state. This is something we've talked about on this program. The majority will be housed in hospitals with the exception of Manchester and Nashua. Governor Chris Sununu says the hubs will be one-stop shops for those seeking help with substance abuse. He says they will be open starting in early January. We promised a discussion on Frank Cepareto, so let's do that. A man claiming to be the business partner of Republican State Representative Frank Cepareto is suing him for assault. The suit claims that the business here was the production of a pornographic film that Frank Cepareto would star in. So, Kevin, what is Cepareto's business partner, Jonathan Carter of Simi Valley, California, alleging?
Yeah, he filed a civil lawsuit and essentially accused Frank Cepareto of assaulting him when he claims that Cepareto became angry about the filming of an explicit scene. And he released to media outlets that wanted to see it images of alleged images of Frank Cepareto acting in this pornographic film. And basically, Cepareto says he's been Kavanaugh'd, meaning he's been charged with false accusations, that he was cleared of criminal charges. He denies the allegations. He says the two were merely producing tourism videos together, and he claims that Carter actually tried to extort money from him, demanded $10,000, or that he would ruin his political career with, as Cepareto claims, these doctored-up videos allegedly showing Cepareto engaging in a porn flick.
And NHPR's Todd Bookman spoke with Cepareto this week. Cepareto's from Derry. He's vice chair of the House Criminal Justice Committee. So in this clip, you'll hear Cepareto first, and that'll be followed by NHPR's Todd Bookman.
This is so absurd that why would anyone, nobody's given credibility to this except the press. Even the police know it's false. So I don't understand why this is getting so, I know it's juicy and it's a week before an election. I know how Judge Kavanaugh feels.
NHPR has reviewed images of the adult film provided by Carter's attorney. The footage appears to show Saporito nude, accompanied by a woman.
Wanted to include Todd Bookman's voice there because he's done some great reporting on this. So is there any primary source document that sort of backs up Saporito's claim of this? Kevin, have you seen anything like that?
No, we haven't. But we also know that that thanks to all kinds of enhanced video techniques, that footage can be doctored and people's faces can be put on other people's bodies. And that's certainly what Saporito alleges, but we haven't seen any firm evidence of that. The fact that, to this point, the fact that there weren't criminal charges brought against Saporito regarding the assault is probably Saporito's best defense, meaning if there really wasn't a physical assault, what is this civil lawsuit really about? Saporito says it's about extortion. This man, Carter, essentially is saying it's about breach of contract.
Okay. One other thing to report here. It's a separate incident, but I want to ask you a question about the context, Kevin, which is that New Hampshire Republican Representative Eric Schlein of Hudson has pleaded guilty to assaulting a 16-year-old girl. The Eagle Tribune is reporting that prosecutors agreed to cap sentence of a year in the House of Corrections, with half of it suspended based on good behavior. After serving 30 days, Schlein would be eligible to serve the remainder under house arrest. He was charged last year with one misdemeanor count of sexual assault and two misdemeanor counts of simple assault. Schlein denied the allegations. So, Kevin, after all your years covering the State House, what do you make of these stories involving state lawmakers? They're unrelated, we should say. The Schlein and Saporito, not related at all, but they're lawmakers involved in this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and with the third largest political body in the free world, this is what you get. I mean, meaning if you have 500, if you round up 500, almost 500 people on Main Street here in Concord, you know, 2, 3 to 5 of them are going to have something salacious or criminal in their past. And that's what we see in New Hampshire, to be sure. We see a couple of these cases, many of them salacious, many of them god-awful. And certainly we had everyone from Ray Buckley, the Democratic chair, to Republican Governor Chris Sununu calling for this representative to immediately resign. He's not running for re-election, but he's continuing to serve and remains a lawmaker until December. It's important to point out, too, Will Delker, who's the judge in this case, is a former state prosecutor. He worked for the Attorney General's office. He rejected an early agreement that the state had reached with Representative Schlein that would have had no jail time. And Delker essentially said, I'm not down with that. He's got to do some time. And that's why in this case, it's going to go to a final sentencing hearing, but Delker would like it to have him serve 30 days in county and then be in home confinement for the remainder of 6 months.
Dean, real quick.
This is something we've talked about for years. When you have a large legislative body like that, people go to vote. They're probably not going to even really know, other than party affiliation, who a lot of these reps are. It's very hard to vet them at the local level. So you're always going to have every election, we always have a few surprises down the road like this. This is not actually all that unusual. It's not always assault. It could be other kinds of issues, but stuff pops up every year.
Okay, we're going to end the show on a positive note for Sox fans, at least. Yankee fans, Dodgers fans, meh, not so great. So, Red Sox won. Let's hear a clip from the final game of the World Series.
Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship. The Boston Red Sox beat the Los Angeles Dodgers 5-1. They win the World Series 4-1. And the Red Sox become the first team in the 21st century with 4 World Championships. Can you believe it? They sprinted from the bullpen. They sprinted from the dugout. They're mobbing each other between third base and home plate. And the Boston Red Sox are the champions for 2018. They win their 119th game this season. Can you believe it?
I mean, I could believe it. They had a great season. So, Anna, I haven't had a chance to talk to you about baseball yet. Are you a baseball fan? Did you watch the World Series?
Aren't you legally obligated to say you're a Red Sox fan?
That's a dodge.
Of course I'm a Red Sox fan. And, you know, I think that one of the great things is, you know, we had that incredibly long game. And I think everyone was still incredibly proud of the performance of the team. You know, I think that even though that was a loss, everybody was saying, wow, what a great job. You know, we had all these, you know, people that we wouldn't necessarily see playing come in. And I also have to say that regardless of what is going on in the national level, you know, Red Sox Nation is not divided. You know,
yes.
That's, you know, there's not a lack of civility there.
And didn't the Dodgers take out like a full page ad in either it's the Los Angeles Times or the Boston Globe, I can't remember which one, just congratulating the team, which is being lauded as a classy move on the part of the Dodgers.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. You know, I think maybe this has something to do with the published reports that the Red Sox spent $300,000 on alcohol since the World Series was, but you also saw, like, the manager Alex Cora the day of the parade really let it all hang out. I mean, basically saying we beat the Yankees 16-1, suck on it. And then he said, I was so thrilled that the last strikeout was against Manny Machado. Who fell down when he struck out in that last clip against Sale for the last out of the series. There was a lot of kind of karma vindication for the Red Sox, who were, even though they'd won 108 games, they were not trusted entering the playoffs. They were considered to be the vulnerable best team in baseball that 2 years in a row had been one and done, couldn't even win a playoff series. So they certainly got some payback this year.
And the one thing that came out of the parade on Wednesday, the court records state 19-year-old Patrick Connolly from Sandwich, Massachusetts, was charged with disorderly conduct for apparently throwing beer cans at the parade and hitting Alex Cora, manager Alex Cora, and denting one of the trophies, which is like, why? Why would you do? Why would you do that?
Well, you know what? He's from Massachusetts, not New Hampshire, so it's not our responsibility.
Come on, as a born and raised in Massachusetts, we're good people. Not all of us throw beer cans at winning teams. Anyway, well, Anna Brown, thank you very much for making your debut on the Roundup. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's so much fun.
And Kevin Landrigan and Dean Spiliotis, thank you again for coming back. We really appreciate it.
Thanks. Being with you, Peter.
So, as we mentioned, the links to all the stories we discussed, as well as the voter resources, will be on our webpage, nhpr.org. Check it out there. That's it for today. But remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. And our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thanks very much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.